races, women's steer wrestling, and mounted rope tricks and gymnastics. The supporting cast was mostly disenfranchised Indians, Mexicans, and cowpunchers, all of whom possessed horsemanship and livestock skills honed on the vanishing frontier. The headliners were Irwin's windblown daughters, Frances, Joella, and Pauline, all fearless horsewomen. As a pigtailed child, Joella had once ditched school to compete in, and win, a horse race against legendary Arapaho riders. She came home to a whipping from her mother and a new horse from her beaming father. Smith worked mostly behind the scenes, but occasionally came into the ring to hold relay horses for Irwin's daughters. Irwin oversaw it all from the back of his huge yellow horse, galloping around the center field with his feet jutting out to the sides, hat waving, booming encouragement to his cowgirls. The nation couldn't get enough of it, and the show was a sellout from coast to coast. In the winter, the Irwin Racing Stable got rolling. Thanks to the wagering ban, the only places for it to go were seedy tracks, backwater ovals so small they were called bull rings, and dirt roads. But this was Irwin's kind of racing. On this circuit, 10-ton Irwin was king. The Irwin Racing Outfit was a little city on railroad tracks. When the bigger tracks, Tijuana, nearby Agua Caliente, or Omaha's Oxarbon, Nebraska spelled backward, were running, Irwin's rail cars would rattle into town. The workers would pull the horses and tack off the cars, throw up the Ringling Brothers tents and seats, open up all-you-can-eat, pitch-till-you-win kitchens inside horse stalls, and settle in for an assault on the racing community. Irwin's stable was probably the largest in America at the time, and may have been the largest ever, but most of the horses would have been hard-pressed to outrun Irwin himself. The vast majority were relegated to claiming races, rock-bottom events in which any competitor can be purchased for a set low price before the race. Irwin took a shotgun approach, throwing as many horses as he could into claiming races in the hope that a few would hit pay dirt, then reloading the ones who hadn't been claimed for another go in a day or two. When the big tracks closed, Smith and the Irwin crew piled back on the rail cars and began endless loops of smaller towns, stopping off in big cities like Kansas City and crossroads like Laramie, Medicine Bow, and Sheridan, Wyoming. Indian reservations were also on the itinerary. Irwin would schedule his arrivals for the day after government checks came, to be sure that everyone had betting money. Upon arrival in the town or reservation, Irwin would trot the horses off the rail cars and straight to the nearest back road or bull ring, where he would implement a nearly fail-safe betting system. He would talk the locals into racing their horses against his for side bets, with a forfeit fee of about $10. He would accept all comers sight unseen, but in the interim between the deal and the race, he would spy on the training of the local horses. If he thought they'd whip his runners, he'd fork over the forfeit fees and skip town, often forgetting to pay his hotel bill on the way out. If the local horses were clearly inferior to his, he'd talk their owners into betting all of their cash. When the cash ran out, he'd work on them until they had staked practically everything they owned, right down to their horse blankets. Irwin's horses almost always won, and Irwin would clean out the locals, pack the horses back on the trains, and leave. "Irwin would put a guy out," remembered Hall of Fame trainer Jimmy Jones, who cut his teeth running horses against Irwin's. "The minute a man got any money, Irwin would rob him of it. He was an old racketeer, in a way." This was a rough life for man and beast. For a wage of about $60 a month, Smith slept and ate in horse stalls and struggled to keep up with the farriery needs of 54 horses. And Irwin was no easy boss. He had a contract jockey named Pablo Martinez, who worked on a set salary instead of being paid per ride. To save himself the $5 fee a replacement rider would cost him, Irwin once hauled poor Martinez out of a hospital bed and made him ride a race. Though he was down with pneumonia, Martinez somehow managed both to live through the afternoon and to win the race before wheezing his way back to the hospital. The horses fared worse. Irwin was known to pack 30 horses onto a single four-door rail car ship them to a race, yank them off the car, and run them without giving them water or letting them warm up. His racing schedules were barbaric. In an era in which one race a week was considered a full calendar, he ran a mare named Miss Cheyenne 16 times in 21 days. He ran another unfortunate horse every day for 8 straight days. Rival trainers who claimed horses from Irwin sometimes found them so exhausted that they had to give them long layoffs before they were capable of running again. The hardship paid off for Irwin, who became the winningest trainer in the nation, but it took a toll on the animals. Smith patched them together, soothed their ailments, and learned. It must have been humiliating for Smith, tending to horses run into exhaustion and watching men and women whose skills had once been so vital prancing around for an audience that had already forgotten their fading world. It is hard to imagine Tom Smith, surrounded by the artificialities of show business, standing in a glitzy show ring, loosing horses to run in chaotic sprints, and not think that something precious was being squandered. But Smith adapted. He was assigned the duty of handling horses for walk-up starts in relay races and matches. In watching thousands of match races, he learned that in most cases, the horse who broke from the start fastest would win. Smith began devising new ways of teaching horses to blow off the line as quickly as possible. For the time being, the knowledge helped keep the Irwin barn solvent. In the long run, it would mean much more. The Depression upended Irwin's business. Workers, at least, were easy to find. He made annual trips through Chicago to buy horses, and to add hands to his roster, he simply swung through the masses of unemployed men milling in the Chicago train stations, hauling aboard anyone who wanted a job. But attendance at his show waned, and paying his men became a problem. Eventually, his money gave out altogether. Irwin made speeches to his employees, pledging that he would pay them, but he couldn't. Irwin's horses still needed care, so Smith remained on the job. One horse had caught his eye, a hopeless wreck named Knighthood. The horse had quite a history. In the 1920s, Knighthood had been handled by an able conditioner named Bob Rowe, one of only a handful of black horsemen training in that era. Under Rowe's handling, Knighthood was a holy terror, winning 30 races and $22,000. The horse became an icon of Tijuana's black community, which turned the horse's race days into joyful celebrations. But as Knighthood aged, his speed diminished. In 1930, he was placed in a claiming race. Rowe didn't want to part with him, but he thought that no one would claim an aged veteran of nearly 150 races. He was wrong. To add insult to injury, the claiming trainer was white. Rowe was heartbroken, and the horse's fans were outraged. After Knighthood changed hands, a rumor began circulating that someone from the horse's erstwhile rooting section had placed a curse on him. Superstition runs long and deep on the backstretch, and the trainer who had claimed the horse was unnerved enough to sell him without ever racing him. The next owner promptly dropped Knighthood into another claiming race. Irwin was not the superstitious sort, and he put in a claim for Knighthood before the race. So did the rueful Rowe. But when a drawing was held to determine who would get the horse, Irwin came out on top. If Knighthood was running under a curse, it worked. In that very race, he was badly injured and limped into Irwin's barn, a seemingly ruined horse. Irwin, who was fond of the horse, refused to euthanize him. Knighthood languished in Irwin's barn, refusing to eat. Smith wanted the horse. After 2 months without pay, he approached Irwin with a proposal. He would call off the debt for past wages if Irwin would give him Knighthood. Irwin at first declined, saying the horse was useless. Smith persisted and prevailed. Smith took Knighthood and disappeared. The horse was gone for so long that everyone on the backstretch assumed he had died. 10 months later, Smith showed up in Tijuana with Knighthood in hand and entered him in a race. In racing, A victory by a horse older than 7, even in claiming races, is an extremely rare event. Knighthood was 10. But the horse's old fans, overjoyed to see him again, rushed the betting windows. In the time it took Knighthood to walk to the post, his betting odds plunged. Knighthood won. His comeback became legend. Irwin knew talent when he saw it, and he offered Smith a shot at training his horses. He sent Smith out to a little bullring track in Cheyenne with a string of runners. The trainees won 29 of 30 races, a feat that may be unequaled at any level of the sport. During a losing streak, Irwin shipped Smith off to Seattle to train another string. Again, Smith turned Irwin's luck around completely. In his course from meadows and rangeland to back roads and bull rings, Tom Smith had cultivated an almost mystical communion with horses. He knew their minds and how to sway them. He knew their bodies and how they telegraphed emotion and sensation, and his hands were a tonic for their pains. In his era, racing was a business made rigid by tradition and imitation, superstition and wives' tales. Even mainstream trainers would drop pennies in mares' water buckets to halt estrus, or exhaust themselves trying to get a mane that fell to the left, a bad omen, to fall to the right. But Smith was a radical departure from conventional trainers. He followed no formulas, no regimens, no superstitious rituals. The wisdom he harbored was frontier-tested. He approached each horse as a distinct individual and followed his own lights and experience to care for it. Horses blossomed in his care. Perhaps Smith spoke so infrequently because he was listening so hard. Horses speak with the smallest of motions. Smith heard and saw everything. Hot walkers leading horses around the shed row to cool them out after workouts would see him squatting down on the floor, staring straight ahead, turning the horses over in his mind. The grooms could circle the barn and come around again, and there he'd be, exactly as he was before. Sometimes he would become so absorbed in watching a horse that he wouldn't move for hours. At times, he wouldn't leave the horses, not even to go over to the grandstand to watch the races, for weeks on end. He built ingenious training devices out of whatever was lying around, brewed up homemade liniments, prepared his horses in exactly the way they said he shouldn't. He carried a stopwatch, but left it in his pocket. He had an uncanny ability to judge a horse's pace by sight, and he resented any distraction that might make him miss a nuance of movement. "I'd rather depend on my eye than on one of those newfangled timepieces," he said. "They take your attention off your horse. I got a watch, and it works too, but the eye is better." For Smith, training was a long, quiet conversation. He was baffled by other people's inability to grasp what he was doing. "It's easy to talk to a horse if you understand his language," he once said. "Horses stay the same from the day they are born until the day they die. They are only changed by the way people treat them." He believed with complete conviction that no animal was permanently ruined. Every horse could be improved. He lived by a single maxim: learn your horse. Each one is an individual. And once you penetrate his mind and heart, you can often work wonders with an otherwise intractable beast. The cowponies, the broncs, the show horses, and the weary racers all had helped to craft Smith into the complete horseman. He was waiting for the right horse. An early spring sun hung in the Mexican sky on March 21, 1934, when 10-ton Irwin shimmied his 425 pounds through the giant rear door of his sedan and pushed off for Cheyenne. The meet, racing session, was over at northern Mexico's Agua Caliente racetrack, and Irwin was due back in Wyoming to tend to his livestock leasing business. He drove north, making his way over the Wyoming border. On a lonely road 14 miles outside Cheyenne, a tire blew. The car veered out of control and plunged into a ditch. rescuers found Irwin in the wreckage with chest and head injuries. 2 days later, he was dead. Irwin's barn was dissolved. Smith wound up on his own at Seattle's Long Acres racetrack. After briefly training a few of Irwin's old horses, he ended up working as a foreman for an old rodeo trick rider turned trainer named Harry Walters. That, too, was short-lived. The owner Walters trained for soon retired from the racing business. Knowing that he was putting Smith out of work again, the owner gave him a gift. It was a horse, a well-traveled $1,500 claimer named O'Reilly. It was a dubious present. The horse was lame. As with knighthood, Smith settled in to work on the horse. After a period of recuperation, he brought O'Reilly back on the track, sound and fit. The horse began winning. Soon Smith was bumping the horse up in class, and he kept finding the winner's circle. Sometime in the latter half of 1934, Tom Smith brought his one-horse stable down to Agua Caliente. O'Reilly did passably well, but Smith was barely making it. The trainer was living out of a horse stall, sharing it with another struggling horseman. He found no clients. He was a few dollars short of flat broke and only marginally employed at the depths of the Depression. He was saved by a remarkable coincidence. Noble Threewitt, the young horseman who was sharing the horse stall with Smith, happened to be training horses for George Giannini, Charles Howard's close friend. While visiting the barn to oversee his horses, Giannini noticed how O'Reilly was flourishing under Smith's care. He realized that wasting away on this Mexican backstretch was a brilliant horseman. Giannini contacted Charles Howard. "Now," he told his friend, "you can have the best trainer in the country." Tom Smith and Charles Howard came face to face. The two men stood in different halves of the century. Smith was the last of the true frontiersmen. Howard was paving Smith's west under the urgent wheels of his automobiles. Howard was driven by image. Smith remained the lone plainsman, forbidding and solitary. But Howard was blessed with an uncanny ability to see potential in unlikely packages. And he had a cavalryman's eye for horsemen. He took one look at Smith, and instincts rang in his head. He drove Smith to his barn and introduced his horses to their new trainer. Chapter 3. Mean, restive, and ragged. Prosperity, in the form of a fat salary from Howard, had found Tom Smith. He had invested a little in the outer man. Gone were the overalls, the big plaid work shirts, the muddied boots, the chaps, the cap. He began showing up at the barn in neat gray suits, dark vests, whipcord trousers, wingtips, and on race days a restrained Republican tie. He had even purchased a camel hair coat. Topping off the ensemble was, of course, the utterly unremarkable gray felt fedora. Head and hat were inseparable. Given that Smith was not a man of particularly noteworthy appearance, it was probably the hat, not his face, that people recognized. A couple of years later, during a stable trip to New York, Smith decided that he had just about worn the hat to death and left the barn in search of a replacement. He stomped back in, brushing past Howard, 4 hours later. On his head was an exact replica of the old hat. Obviously in sour spirits, he muttered that he had spent the entire morning scouring the town trying to find a hat for $2.50. "Couldn't find one," he grumbled. "Had to get this one." Howard asked him how much the new hat had set him back.
$3.
The new raiment fit him. Tom Smith had arrived. He had taken Howard's ill-bred yearlings, worked with him in solitude for a year, then slipped them into barn 38 at Santa Anita, and hung out his shingle. Right from the start he attracted curious glances. Someone saw him wrapping up an alarm clock in a towel and burying it in the straw of a filly's stall, letting her get used to the ticking. Then, while everyone at the track was speculating about what he was up to, Smith tacked up the horse, fished out the clock, and went to the track. He loaded the filly in the gate, set off the clock alarm, and let her rip. He brought her back, and did it again and again, until she was primed to jackrabbit down the track when she heard a bell. Pretty soon, people were coming around just to watch Smith. No one had ever seen a trainer work like this. The Howards motored down and watched, too, feeding sugar cubes to their horses and surely wondering what they had gotten themselves into. But then the races began and Smith's horses started winning. Not just a little. Smith owned the place. The horses were almost all long shots, because no one trusted what Smith was doing, but that just made the payoffs for Howard's bets all the greater. The filly, trained with the alarm clock, a 70-to-1 long shot, smoked a giant field right out of the gate to win the biggest juvenile race of the season, paying $143.60 for every $2 bet. A meet record. Smith won so much that he started to make the papers almost daily. The racetrackers were soon calling the winner's circle Howard's Half Acre, and Barn 38 was the track's runaway leader in wins. Howard and Smith came to an understanding. Howard called his trainer Tom. Smith, without fail, called his employer Mr. Howard. The Howards came to the barn almost every morning, and Charles stayed on, sometimes for 14 hours at a stretch. He brought in a big truck of a saddle horse named Chulo so he could ride out with Smith on the track. But he knew his place. He didn't mess with Smith's business. For a hands-on executive like Howard, the urge to tinker must have been strong, but he was smart enough to recognize superior understanding, no matter how bizarre the training practices looked. "Mr. Howard pays me for results," Smith once said. "He doesn't ask questions." In turn, Smith put up with Howard's love of the spotlight, the long stream of friends and reporters he brought to the barn, his need to be in the center of things. To a point. If Howard's friends got too close to his horses, Smith would snap at them to get back. The union had its rough points, but it worked. Howard was hungry for more winning. As the spring waned, they decided to take the show on the road. The horses would go to a little track in Michigan called the Detroit Fairgrounds. Smith was sent on alone, farther east on a different mission. Howard wanted some mature horses to augment his fleet of juveniles. Howard had the kind of money to turn the head of any major league owner, and he could have used it to acquire a ready-made stable of proven runners. But Howard didn't want to take the easy route. He wanted a bargain animal, whose talent had been overlooked by the old money lords of Eastern racing. He knew he had the trainer who could find him. In June 1936, Smith arrived in Massachusetts. He traveled from track to track, looking at hundreds of cheap horses, but he couldn't find the one he sought. On the sweltering afternoon of June 29th, at Boston's Suffolk Downs, the horse found him. The colt was practically sneering at him. Smith was standing by the track rail, weighing the angles and gestures of low-level horses as they streamed to the post, when a weedy 3-year-old bay stopped short in front of him, swung his head high, and eyed him with an arch expression completely unsuited to such a rough-hewn animal. "He looked right down his nose at me," Smith remembered later, like he was saying, "Who the devil are you?" Man and horse stood on opposite sides of the rail for a long moment, sizing each other up. An image materialized in Smith's mind. The Colorado Ranges, a tough little cow horse. The pony boy leading the colt to the post tugged him on his way. Smith watched the animal's rump swing around and go. Thin, yes, but he had an engine on him. Smith flipped to the horse's profile in the track program. The colt was a descendant of the mighty Man-O-War through his sire, the brilliantly fast, exceptionally handsome hardtack. But his stunted build reflected none of the beauty and breadth of his forebears. The colt's body, built low to the ground, had all the properties of a cinder block. Where hardtack had been tall, sleek, tapered, every line suggesting motion, his son was blunt, coarse, rectangular, stationary. He had a sad little tail, barely long enough to brush his hocks. His stubby legs were a study in unsound construction, with squarish, asymmetrical baseball glove knees that didn't quite straighten all the way, leaving him in a permanent semi-crouch. Thanks to his unfortunate assembly, his walk was an odd, straddle-legged motion that was often mistaken for lameness. Asked to run, he would drop low over the track and fall into a comical version of what horsemen call an egg-beater gait, making a spastic sideways flailing motion with his left foreleg as he swung it forward, as if he were swatting at flies. His gallop was so disorganized that he had a maddening tendency to whack himself on the front ankle with his own hind hoof. One observer compared his action to a duck waddle. All of this raggedness was not helped by his racing schedule. His career had been noteworthy only in its appalling rigor. Though only 3 years old, he had already run 43 races, far more than most horses contest in their entire careers. But somehow, after throwing a fit in the starting gate and being left flat-footed at the bell, the colt won his race that day. While being unsaddled, he leveled his wide-set, intelligent eyes on Smith again. Smith liked that look and nodded at the horse. "Darn if the little rascal didn't nod back at me," Smith said later. "Kinda like he was paying me an honor to notice me." He was a horse whose quality, an admirer would write, was mostly in his heart, and Tom Smith had been the first to recognize it. A man for whom words were encumbrances, Smith didn't take note of the horse's name, but he memorized him nonetheless. He spoke to the horse as he was led away. "I'll see you again." The horse's name was Seabiscuit, and for a bent-backed trainer on the other side of the backstretch, the brief exchange of glances between the horse and Tom Smith was the beginning of the end of a long, pounding headache. In 1877, when James Fitzsimmons was three, the Coney Island Jockey Club annexed his family's Brooklyn neighborhood and literally built a track around his house, leaving it standing in the infield while the racing world revolved around it. Sonny Jim, as admirers called him, was thus entangled in the racetrack from the beginning of his conscious life. He never escaped it. "All I ever wanted to do," he once said, "was be with the horses." At age 10, he worked as a dishwasher in the track kitchen. He moved on to a harrowing career as an exercise boy, then became a jockey. "I was vaccinated for jockey," he liked to say, "but it didn't take." He survived a rocky reinsman's career, then hung it up to try his hand at training. He had found his niche. Fitzsimmons soon established himself as the most successful conditioner of thoroughbreds in the nation. That June, he was 61 and imprisoned in a body so ravaged by arthritis that his upper spine was slowly collapsing forward, driving his head so far downward that in time he would have to learn to identify his horses solely by their feet. He coaxed a phenomenal amount of work out of his rigid body, laboring so hard over his horses through the week that he had to sleep straight through Sunday to recover. The work paid off. Fitzsimmons had cultivated the talents of myriad champions, including Gallant Fox and Omaha, two of the first three horses to sweep the Kentucky Derby, Preakness Stakes, and Belmont Stakes, the Triple Crown. His greatness was beyond question. His was a household name across America, and trainers regarded him with profound reverence. Tom Smith was no exception. Fitzsimmons was apparently the only man whom Smith ever regarded with awe. The events that brought the two trainers together had begun in 1928, when Fitzsimmons was entrusted with the 2-year-old Hardtack, sire of the colt Smith would see at Suffolk Downs. Owned by Gladys Phipps and her brother Ogden Mills, operators of the East's legendary Wheatley stable, Hardtack was a copper-colored paragon of symmetry, grace, and blinding speed. Everything about him was superlative, including his single flaw. He was uncontrollable. The characteristic had surfaced, to a greater or lesser degree, in nearly every horse to descend from his great-grandsire, Hastings, a 1,000-pound misanthrope for the ages. On the track, where he won races as prestigious as the 1896 Belmont Stakes, Hastings deliberately rammed and attempted to maul his competitors. Off the track, he ripped groom after groom to ribbons. "He went to his death, unreconstructed and unloved," wrote Peter Chu in American Heritage magazine, "having left his mark literally and figuratively on many a stable hand." Hastings passed both speed and malevolence down to his son, Fair Play, who in turn bequeathed it to his incomparable son, Manowar. Racing in 1919 and 1920, this immense red animal so devastated his competition that he won by as many as 100 lengths and set numerous speed records. Manowar lost only once in his career, to a colt coincidentally named Upset, a defeat that still ranks among the most shocking in sports history. It has long been part of racing lore that the use of the word upset to mean the surprise defeat of a favorite originates from Manowar's shocking loss to the horse Upset in 1920. Though a good story, it is false. Use of the word upset in this sense predates that race. In fact, reporters covering the race noted how coincidental it was that Manowar should lose to a horse with such a name. Arguably the greatest runner who ever lived, Manowar became a prolific sire, populating the racing world with beautiful man-eaters. A typical example was War Relic. While a youngster, he acquainted the world with his jolly personality by stomping a groom to death. His trainer, Colton Utz, tracked down leading jockey Tommy Luther, famed for his fearlessness and ability to stay aboard even the most unrideable beasts, and brought him to the training farm to work with the horse. Luther was appalled at just how bad the colt was. "The horse," remembered Luther, "would do everything wrong." Luther and Utz put War Relic through endless hours of patient schooling until they felt he was ready to go to the track without killing anyone. At Rhode Island's Narragansett Park, they entered him in a race. War Relic displayed cherubic behavior, grabbed the lead out of the gate, and never relinquished it, winning with consummate ease. "Next time he runs," Luther told his wife Helen, "bet $100. It'll be like taking candy from a baby." Helen did as her husband asked, then sat in the stands on race day, terrified and praying. War Relic rocketed to the lead, held it around the track, and flew into the home stretch all alone. Luther thought his $100 bet was going to cash in, but War Relic had been an angel for exactly 1 3/4 races, and he was pushing his limits. As the crowd cheered him on from the grandstand, he abruptly bolted to the inside, hit the rail, and stopped dead, vaulting Luther into a spiraling dive directly toward the toothy track harrows parked in the infield. Luther was on the verge of being skewered. Throwing out his hands, he caught the rail, swooped around it like a gymnast, and made a clean dismount onto the track. Steward Tom Thorpe walked across the course and stared at Luther's uninjured body, incredulous. "Tommy," he said, "you must have had somebody praying for you." Praying was usually the best you could do when confronted with a son of Manowar. Hardtack, also a Manowar's son, inherited the fable Hastings' temper distilled to crystal purity. The colt spent 3 years plunging around the track in devil-possessed rages and nurturing a vendetta against the hapless assistant starters assigned to hold his head in the doorless starting gate. He terrorized them without mercy, They feared and loathed him without reserve. Hardtack became a notorious rogue, inspiring turf rider John Hervey to dub him the arch-exponent of recalcitrance. Fitzsimmons had gentled plenty of miscreants, but he had no answers for Hardtack. By some miracle, on three occasions, he was able to coax the horse into playing the racing game. Running with an unusual gait in which one foreleg jabbed out as he swung it forward, Hardtack channeled savagery into velocity, whipping top horses and stakes races, the highest level of racing, and breaking speed records. But these were only skirmishes. Hardtack won the war. At the starting gate before a race in 1931, he issued his Declaration of Independence. When the starter banged the bell, Hardtack rooted his hooves in the ground and stayed right where he was. Fitzsimmons packed him up and shipped him back to owner Phipps. By the time Hardtack entered stud in 1932, his name burned in infamy. No one was foolish enough to pay a stud fee to breed a mare to him. Poor Gladys Phipps offered him to Maryland breeders for free, but she couldn't find a single taker. She then asked Kentucky's famed Claiborne Farm, which boarded her mares, to stand him at stud. They declined. Eager to see some return on her investment, she had him vanned far down a lonely Kentucky lane onto a farm called Bluegrass Heights, and parked him in a paddock deep in a grove of mulberry trees. She sent some of her own mares over from Claiborne to be bred to him. One of them was a mealy melon-kneed horse named Swing On. She, too, had once been in Fitzsimmons' care, but though she had shown a quick turn of foot occasionally, she hadn't trained well enough for Fitzsimmons to think she was going to be much of a racehorse. He had retired her without ever racing her. She was nicely bred, so Phipps decided to send her to Hardtack's court along with three other mares. Swing On and her fellow mares came back to Claiborne pregnant. Phipps crossed her fingers, hoping that these matings would recreate the perfect forms of the forebears without the tyrannical disposition. They didn't. At New York's Aqueduct Race Course, late in 1934, Hardtack's first two yearlings stepped off a rail car into Fitzsimmons' care. Swing On's son, Seabiscuit, a synonym for his sire's name, and the other colt, Grog, could not have looked less like their sire. Noah, the foaling groom at Claiborne, had summed it up about as well as anyone when he pulled Seabiscuit into the world. "Runty little thing." Claiborne handlers had been so dismayed with the colt that they had hidden him in a back barn when Phipps came to look over her new crop of horses. A year of maturing hadn't helped much. "Seabiscuit was so small," said Fitzsimmons, "that you might mistake him for a lead pony." Curiously, Hardtack appeared to be stamping his foals in a mold that was the polar opposite of his own. The only similarity, evident in Seabiscuit, was that swatting foreleg. Not only were these colts strange-looking, shaggy and awkward, but aside from the slight difference in their mutually diminutive heights, Grog was a hair shorter, they were identical. Without the assistance of a halter nameplate, virtually no one could tell them apart. The colts must have liked the mirror image. They had become inseparable in the Claiborne paddocks. Fortunately, Hardtack's raging temper had also come out in the genetic wash. Seabiscuit floated along in a state of contented bovine torpor. Sleeping was his favorite pastime. Horses usually sleep in numerous brief sessions scattered throughout the day and night. About 20% of their daytime is spent snoozing. Because of the size and configuration of their bodies, they suffer impeded breathing and circulation when recumbent, and as prey animals who have trouble getting to their feet quickly, they are instinctively disinclined to stay down. As a result, the vast majority of horses' sleeping is done standing, which they can do thanks to ligaments that lock their leg joints in the extended position. The average stabled horse spends just 5 minutes at a time lying down to sleep, almost always at night. Seabiscuit was the exception. He could keel over and snooze for hours on end. His inability to straighten his knees all the way may have been the culprit, preventing him from locking his forelegs in the upright position. Fortunately, he suffered no negative consequences. While every other horse at the track raised hell demanding breakfast, he slept long and late, stretching out over the floor of his stall in such deep sedation that the grooms had to use every means in their power just to get him to stand up. He was so quiet that Fitzsimmons' assistant trainers once forgot all about him and left him in a van for an entire afternoon in brutal heat while they went for a beer. They found him there hours later, pitched over on his side, blissfully asleep. No one had ever seen a horse so relaxed. Fitzsimmons would remember him as a big dog, the most easygoing horse he ever trained. The only thing Seabiscuit took seriously, aside from his beauty rest, was eating, which he did constantly, with great vigor. He may have been an amiable little horse, but his career prospects looked dim. He was as slow as growing grass. He barely kept up with his training partners, lagging along behind with happy ineptitude. Worked over and over again, he showed no improvement whatsoever. "The boys who took care of him could do anything with him," Fitzsimmons said. "Anything, that is, except to get him to run in the mornings. I thought he simply couldn't run." But in time, something in Seabiscuit's demeanor, perhaps a conspicuous lack of sweating in the workouts, perhaps a gleam in the horse's eye that hinted at devious intelligence, made Fitzsimmons question his assumptions. "He was as wise as a little owl," Fitzsimmons remembered later. "He was almost too quiet, too docile." Fitzsimmons began to wonder if this horse might be just as obstreperous as his sire, only much more cunning in his methods. His father had raged. Seabiscuit seemed amused. "He struck me," Fitzsimmons said, "as a bird that could sing, but wouldn't unless we made him." Fitzsimmons made him. "I decided to fool the biscuit," he explained, "to prove to him he wasn't fooling me." One morning, when working all the yearlings over 2 furlongs, 1/4 mile, in sets of 2, he paired Seabiscuit with Faust, the fastest yearling in the barn and a future major stakes winner. He told Seabiscuit's exercise rider to find a stick to use as a whip. This was a radical departure from Fitzsimmons' regular training practices, which mandated that exercise riders never use whips on their horses. The trainer believed that racehorses were instinctively hard-trying, competitive creatures who did not need to be forced to exert themselves. During one race in his jockey days, he heard another rider cursing after dropping his whip on what he thought was an otherwise sure winner. Fitzsimmons handed the jockey his whip, then rode his own horse right past him to win, urging him with nothing but hands and voice. But Seabiscuit could not be coaxed into showing any speed at all, and to find out if the horse was hoodwinking him, Fitzsimmons opted to make an exception to his no-whip rule. To ensure that the stick would not hurt Seabiscuit, Fitzsimmons had the rider select one that was flat, so it would merely slap his flank. "Keep this colt right up with Faust as close as you can," he later recalled telling the jockey. "Just see how many times you can hit him going 1/4 mile. Fitzsimmons expected that, at best, Seabiscuit would be able to cling to Faust for a little while. Faust never had a chance. Slapped over and over again with the stick, Seabiscuit blew Faust's doors off, covering 1/4 mile in an impossible 22 2/5 seconds. It may have been the fastest quarter ever run by a yearling. Today, on tracks that are several seconds faster than they were in the 1930s, such a workout time is considered exceptionally swift, even for a mature horse. The bird could sing. "I found out why he wasn't running," said Fitzsimmons. "It wasn't that he couldn't. It was that he wouldn't." Fitzsimmons realized that he was confronted with a behavioral problem at least as maddening as hard-tacked murderousness, pathological indolence. "He was lazy," marveled Fitzsimmons. "Dead lazy." The colt had proved that hard-tacked speed lived on in his homely little body, but the revelation didn't make him any more eager to work. Though he later denied it, Fitzsimmons evidently suspended his no-whip rule indefinitely with Seabiscuit. "We used a whip on him every time we sent him to the track, and we used it freely, too," he once conceded. "When we didn't, he loafed along." The horse performed better, but he still wasn't working hard enough to get himself fit. Fitzsimmons came to the conclusion that the only way to tap into the potential he had glimpsed was to race him hard. Very hard. His logic? Since the horse rested himself so much more than other horses, he could stand up to an unusually heavy racing schedule. And since the horse was uncommonly intelligent, he would know to back off if he became overworked. Entrusted to assistant trainer James Fitzsimmons Jr., while Sonny Jim manned the helm on the more precocious horses, Seabiscuit began a regimen of incredibly rigorous campaigning. Thoroughbreds are placed in age classes according to the year in which they are born, rather than their birth month. On January 1st, all horses graduate to the next age class, even if their birthdays fall months later. Seabiscuit had been a very late foal, born at the end of May 1933. But in January 1935, half a year short of his actual birthday, he was deemed a two-year-old, officially eligible to race. On January 19th, he began his career at Florida's Hialeah Racetrack. He finished fourth. It wasn't good enough for the Wheatley stable, which was overflowing with top prospects. 3 days later, Seabiscuit was put up for sale, placed in a rock-bottom claiming race for a tag of just $2,500. No one wanted him even at that price, and he lost again. James Jr. then put the colt on the road, touring through 13 tracks up and down the East Coast to run in low-rent races spaced as little as 2 days apart. 16 times Seabiscuit ran, 16 times he lost. From Florida to Rhode Island and practically everywhere in between, he was offered in the cheapest claiming races. No one took him. Once in a while, the hardtack speed reappeared. In the colt's 18th start, for no explicable reason, he finally won, clocking a sterling time. Rolled back into another claiming race just 4 days later, he broke a track record, an unheard-of feat for a claimer. But the brilliant form fell apart immediately, leaving him back among the dregs of racing. He plodded along for another few months, then rebounded with three moderate wins in the fall of 1935, before sinking back into failure. By season's end, Seabiscuit had been shipped over 6,000 miles and raced a staggering 35 times, at least triple the typical workload. Grog had fared even worse, racing 37 times before being claimed for a paltry $1,500. Sooner or later, it appeared, Seabiscuit would meet the same fate. At least the problem of how to get Seabiscuit in shape had been solved. Raced constantly, he surely no longer lacked for fitness. But his problems were predominantly mental. By the time his two-year-old season drew to a close, he was showing signs of burnout. He became edgy. He stopped sleeping, spending his nights pacing around and around his stall. On the track, he fought savagely in the starting gate and sulked his way through races, sometimes trailing the field from start to finish. A young jockey named George Wolfe, aboard for one of these woeful performances, summed up the colt's mental state in four words: mean, restive, and ragged. Years later, Fitzsimmons would argue that the intense campaign through which he and his assistants put Seabiscuit gave the horse the seasoning that enabled him to race for so long as an older horse. There may be some merit to this, as recent research suggests that steady, hard training and racing in sound horses, especially in young ones, may give bones and soft tissue the loading they need for optimal durability, and give horses the wind foundation to tackle harder racing later. But such a thing can be overdone. Thoroughbreds run because they love to, but when over-raced they can become stale and uninterested, especially when repeatedly trounced and bullied by their riders, as Seabiscuit was. By the spring of 1936, he was clearly miserable, and it is hard to avoid the conclusion that his exhausting schedule was the cause. Given that he wasn't winning, or even running passably well, it's very difficult to defend it. Seabiscuit had the misfortune of living in a stable whose managers simply didn't have the time to give his mind the painstaking attention it needed. Fitzsimmons's barn, consisting of horses owned by the Wheatley and Belair stables, was teeming with precocious youngsters and proven high-class older horses. As Seabiscuit ground through his first season, Fitzsimmons was touring the nation amid a storm of publicity as Seabiscuit's stablemate, Omaha, made a successful assault on the Triple Crown. The following season, Fitzsimmons turned his attention to the promising Granville, readying him for a shot at the 36th Kentucky Derby. It was often said that Fitzsimmons nearly ruined Seabiscuit by using him as a workmate for Granville, pulling him up during hot contests to bolster Granville's confidence. This is highly unlikely. Since Seabiscuit refused to exert himself in workouts, it would have made little sense to pair him with the brilliantly fast Granville, especially as Granville already had a designated workmate who traveled with him. Further, as Fitzsimmons often explained, Granville was owned by Belair Stable, Seabiscuit by Wheatley, and one of horse training's cardinal rules is that the horse of one owner is never sacrificed to benefit the horse of another. Fitzsimmons would certainly have avoided this conflict of interest. But Granville's presence probably did work against Seabiscuit simply by virtue of the demands that a Kentucky Derby contender makes on his trainer. Granville was a temperamental animal who needed coddling and little time was left over for the Seabiscuits and Grogs of the stable. The Fitzsimmons barn was one in which a horse who did not display spectacular talent could slip through the cracks. That is what happened to Seabiscuit, and Fitzsimmons knew it. He had something when he wanted to show it, the trainer later admitted. It was like he was saving himself for something. Trouble was, I didn't have time right then to find out for what. In the spring of 36, Fitzsimmons set off for the Triple Crown prep races with Granville, leaving Seabiscuit in the hands of assistant trainer George Tappan. The horse's campaign became a roadshow of athletic futility. Seabiscuit shipped all over the Northeast, never stayed more than 2 or 3 weeks in one place, averaged one race every 5 days, and racked up losses to inferior horses practically every time out. But just as in his freshman season, he showed glimmers of promise. There was a decent effort at New York's Jamaica racetrack, then a modest allowance win at Narragansett Park. The decent performances were mixed with laughably bad outings, 2 10-length thumpings, one of which saw him lag in 12th from start to finish, but Fitzsimmons was becoming more and more convinced that the colt could be improved. He never stopped trying to encourage Seabiscuit to work harder in the mornings, including offering a $1 incentive, twice the standard fee, to any exercise rider who could get him to run a half mile in anything under a sleepy 50 seconds. None of them, Fitzsimmons lamented, ever won the dollar. The puzzle of the horse weighed on Fitzsimmons's mind. One morning at Aqueduct, while standing by the track to watch Granville complete his preparations for the Kentucky Derby, reporters were surprised to hear Sonny Jim ruminating not on his stable star, but on the unknown Seabiscuit. The colt was, said the trainer, a pretty nice hoss, the kind that might take some time to get going, but would take a lot of beating when he did. As Fitzsimmons was warming up to Seabiscuit, Wheatley was cooling off. Gladys Phipps was convinced that even if Fitzsimmons could make a silk purse out of this sow's ear, the horse was still much too small to make it in the more lucrative handicap division, in which he would have to carry heavier weights. The new crop of horses coming into the barn was a big one, and the stable string had to be culled. Seabiscuit topped the list of disposable horses, and Phipps was eager to find a buyer. Unable to do so, she tried to pawn the colt off as a polo pony. The prospective buyer took one look at the colt's crooked legs and passed. Early that spring, before she left for a tour of Europe, Phipps set a $5,000 price on Seabiscuit, hoping he would be sold before she came back. Fitzsimmons had bigger things to worry about. In early May, a few days before Seabiscuit earned $25 for finishing fourth in a race at Jamaica Racetrack, Fitzsimmons and Granville shipped off to Churchill Downs to go for the $37,725 winner's share of the purse in the Kentucky Derby. Coming into the race with an excellent shot at winning, Granville fumed, stormed, and lathered through the post parade and bounced and shimmied in the starting gate. When the bell rang, he was sideswiped by a horse named He Did and nearly went down. He dumped jockey Jimmy Stout and took off for a glorious solo gallop around the track. In Baltimore's Preakness Stakes, Stout stuck to his stirrups but finished second to Derby winner Bold Venture, foiled by the brilliant reinsmanship of Seabiscuit's one-time jockey, George Wolfe. In early June, as Seabiscuit was being humiliated in a cheap stakes race in New Hampshire, Granville finally lived up to expectations by winning New York's Belmont Stakes, the final jewel in the Triple Crown. He would be named Horse of the Year for 1936. With a competitor like Granville in his barn, Fitzsimmons now had no reason to be fretting over a colt like Seabiscuit. In June, after being whipped by a total of more than 25 lengths in his previous three starts, Seabiscuit appeared at Massachusetts Suffolk Downs to compete against a lowly field vying for a $700 winner's purse. There, Tom Smith bent over the track rail and exchanged looks with him for the first time. Countless horsemen had run their eyes over that plain bay body. None of them had seen what Smith saw. In a private box above Saratoga Racecourse on August 3, 1936, Marcella and Charles Howard surveyed a field of generic $6,000 claimers. In town to bid on the yearling sales on behalf of Bing Crosby, they had stopped by the track to take in a few races. Charles pointed to an especially homely colt and asked his wife what she thought of him. She offered a wager of a cool drink that the horse would lose. He accepted the bet, and they watched as the colt led wire to wire. Marcella bought her husband a lemonade. Sitting together in the clubhouse that afternoon, husband and wife felt a pull of intuition. Howard contacted Smith and told him he had a horse he wanted him to look at, stabled in the Fitzsimmons barn. Smith was probably skeptical. That spring he had been shown nearly two dozen prospects and had frowned over every one of them. Smith walked over to the Wheatley barn and presented himself to Fitzsimmons, asking to see the horse of whom Howard had spoken. Fitzsimmons walked the colt in question out of his stall. Smith recognized him immediately. It was Seabiscuit. Smith saw the buck knees, the insistent pressure of ribs under skin, the weariness of the body. But he saw something else, too. He tracked down Howard. "Better come and see him for yourself," he said. Led out of his stall with the two men standing by, Seabiscuit headbutted Howard. Smith made his case with four sentences. "Get me that horse. He has real stuff in him. I can improve him. I'm positive." It was a statement astounding for its audacity. Tom Smith was an obscure trainer with 1 year's experience with the mainstream stable. Fitzsimmons was the undisputed leader of the nation's training ranks. If Sonny Jim couldn't get a horse to win, no one could. Few trainers, even the most cocksure, were fool enough to buy a horse from the master. For Smith, walking into that barn must have been akin to entering a cathedral. Telling Fitzsimmons that he could improve on his work must have felt like sacrilege. And there was another reason for worry. Howard sent veterinarians to inspect the horse. They were only lukewarm about his prospects, eyeing that iffy left foreleg and pronouncing the horse only serviceably useful. But in this horse, Smith knew there was something lying dormant. The bump from Seabiscuit's head took care of Howard's sentimental side. "I fell in love with him," he said later, "right then and there." Marcella was sold and urged him not to wait. But Howard's business side was still not convinced. He contacted co-owner Ogden Mills and made an offer of $8,000 with one string attached. Seabiscuit had to perform well in his next start. Though $8,000 sounds like a lot in Depression dollars, it was a relatively low price for a racehorse. Horse racing was one of the most lucrative sports in America at that time, and even undistinguished horses often earned $2,000 to $3,000 a year. In addition, the breeding industry was potentially profitable, adding considerably to the value of horses. Seabiscuit was reasonably well-bred, giving him additional value as a stallion. The appointed day arrived with pouring rain, and Fitzsimmons considered scratching Seabiscuit, but no one else seemed to want to run in the mud either. All day long, trainers kept scratching horses from the race. By afternoon, only one other horse remained in the field.